Introducing Home Care Plus, a new subscription service from Lowe's that helps make life easier by giving members a hand with home maintenance. Let Lowe's tackle the tasks you keep meaning to do, like electric dryer vent cleaning, replacing hard-to-reach light bulbs, and more. Subscribe to Home Care Plus for just $99 a year and consider your to-do list done. Members get more at Lowe's. Available in select zip codes only. Cancel anytime. Non-refundable fee. Product purchase required. Terms and service restrictions apply. Details at Lowe's.com/terms. Subject to change.
Astonishing Legends Network.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back. Just a couple of things before we get started. I wanted to bring your attention to a podcast that I guested on recently, a really wonderful show called Strange. So what happened was the host of the podcast, Christopher Wynn, got in touch after hearing this podcast, episode 105, The Ghost of 29 Megacycles, and he basically asked me if I would just sort of retell that story in my own words on his show, which of course I was happy to do. But his show, kind of like ours, is like a real total audio experience. He has original composed music and there's sound design. But what's really cool about this episode is, if you recall, The Ghost of 29 Megacycles is the story of the Spiracom, which is that weird machine that sets down a tone and allegedly facilitated a two-way conversation between the living and the dead. So on his show, he actually works in bits and pieces of the actual Spiracom recordings and weaves it into the soundscape of the story in just the most amazing way. It's really cool. I'm excited for you guys to hear what he did with the story. So now, when I did his show, I wasn't familiar with it, so I didn't listen to any of it before I did it because I didn't want to get freaked out or intimidated or anything. But after I did it, then I went back and listened to all the episodes, which are just basically people coming on and telling very, very weird, mostly supernatural stories that have occurred in their lives. And like I said, it's just beautifully produced. It's really great. It's absolutely riveting. So, of course, I'd love for you to listen to the episode that features me, but I really want you to check them all out. There's not that many episodes. It's sort of been sporadic over the last few years, but I spoke to Christopher. He's planning on picking things back up and releasing more episodes regularly in the future. So anyway, definitely check this out. I really enjoyed it. If you like this show, you will definitely like Strange. So check out Christopher Wynn's Strange podcast. All right, here we go. Hello from Heaven by Bill Guggenheim and Judy Guggenheim. I love everything about Hello from Heaven, Bantam Books, 1996, except the title. My first problem is the word heaven. It makes me squeamish. I know the field of after-death research isn't exactly considered hard science, but Hello from Heaven sounds like a pamphlet you'd find in a church vestibule. And it makes the book an easy target for skeptics who say, oh, well, you're just pushing a religious agenda. You see, heaven isn't a very scientific word. It's too religious and optimistic. To be fair, Hello from Heaven is a very optimistic book if you're hoping for life after death. The book contains over 300 stories of spontaneous after-death communications. Stories reported by people from all walks of life, all religions, even atheists. Why couldn't they just call it Hello from Beyond? Or Hello from the Afterlife? Or even better, Spontaneous After-Death Communications. I tell you, nothing makes me trust a book more than a boring title. But publishers aren't stupid, and they know that putting the word heaven in the title will increase book sales dramatically. So, okay, maybe I can let that slide. But guys, that exclamation point is killing me. The last book I read with an exclamation point in the title was written by Dr. Seuss. Hello from Heaven is what you might call afterlife communication porn. It's just one story after another, each of them about a page long. Just the good stuff, all told in the first person. It's sort of a paranormal letters to penthouse. True stories from people who have had experiences that you and I can only dream of. You know the kind. Dear Penthouse, I never believed the letters in your magazine until last week when I happened to stop by my history professor's office to discuss my rather disappointing midterm exam. You'll never believe what happened next. Only in this book, the letters are different. They start with phrases like, "My mother was killed in a gas explosion, and there was no physical body to be viewed." And then the writer goes on to describe an after-death communication. By the way, I'm not kidding. That story is on page 184 of the paperback. Check it out. I read this book, covered a sky blue cover, in my office bathroom. I did about one story per visit. Luckily, I'm almost 60, so I spend a lot of time in the bathroom. And I got through the book pretty quickly. And the thing you'll notice, the real power of this book, is that when you read these stories one after another, the similarities far outweigh the differences. You find your skepticism worn down by the sheer volume of reports. Even if you don't buy some of them, there's still too many left over to dismiss the looming fact that there is definitely something going on here. The question, of course, is, what is going on? Are regular people actually being visited by the conscious spirits of their dead loved ones? Or is something else at work? Mind you, the book never asks this question. The book's point of view is completely carved up. You live on after you die, full stop. In a way, this book is the experiential inverse of a different book I covered earlier this season, Induced After-Death Communication. The allure of these stories is that they happen to people out of nowhere. They're just going about their daily life when something wonderful happens. Again, just like Penthouse. In fact, for me, the perfect book would be something that combined both. You know, just when I was noticing how cute the pizza boy was, he smiled and said, "I heard you wanted extra sausage." That's when we both saw the ghost of my dead grandmother in the living room, radiating light, telling us she was finally free of pain and happy and that she loved us. The pizza boy and I were so overcome with emotion that we tore each other's clothes off and, well, you know. It's hard not to envy the people in this book. In the majority of cases, these events bring great peace to the people who have them. As strange as the stories are, and many of them are quite strange indeed, the end result is a kind of spiritual clarity. It's as if the experiencers have been shown the answer key at the end of life's textbook, and the answer is simply, it's going to be okay. One of the questions we struggle with as human beings is very simple. Is it okay to feel like things are going to be okay? If someone's posing the question to you, you're likely to say, well, yeah, sure, of course you're allowed to feel okay. But if we pose the questions to ourselves, are we allowed to be okay? The answer is a resounding no. Because bad things happen all the time. People get sick, they get hurt, they die. Life on Earth is not okay. The stories in Hello from Heaven! And yes, I am going to say it like that every time. Do two things at once. They acknowledge the horror of our mortal life, the excruciating pain of loss, and then they say, but apparently at the very, very end, it's not so bad. In fact, it's not even the end. Bill and Judy Guggenheim collaborated on the 7-year creation of this book, even though they were divorced at the time. And if that doesn't make you believe in the impossible, nothing will. Like all the best stories of the supernatural, this one started with an episode of The Phil Donahue Show. Okay, Phil Donahue hosted a daytime talk show for 29 years, from 1967 to 1996. And if you don't know who this guy is, my God, get on the internet and find out. It was on an episode in 1976 featuring Elizabeth Kubler-Ross that Bill Guggenheim, a staunch skeptic, heard Dr. Kubler-Ross talk calmly and coherently about the evidence for life after death. Bill knew he had unresolved issues concerning his father, who had died when he was very young. So he decided to attend a workshop that she was hosting near his home in Florida, and it was there, hearing stories from bereaved parents and spouses who had lost loved ones, only to have those same loved ones appear to them later to offer messages of comfort and hope, that he began to seriously consider the idea that after-death communication might be a real thing. For years, both Bill and Judy Guggenheim kept in touch with the people Bill had met at the conference, and their interest in the subject grew. Then, in 1980, Bill had a strange experience of his own. In the middle of the afternoon, he heard a clear, calm voice in his head say, "Go outside and check the swimming pool." So he did. He found his 2-year-old son floating there, unconscious. Bill pulled him out and managed to revive him. The entire terrifying event lasted less than 2 minutes, but its impact was undeniable. What was that voice he had heard? Where had it come from? While this was not in any way a traditional ADC, after-death communication, it kicked open the doors of Bill's perceptions a little wider. He only heard that voice one more time in his life. It was 8 years later, and by then he and Judy were divorced. But his interest in after-death communication hadn't ebbed. In fact, it had become something of a full-time hobby, attending conferences, reading journals, volunteering with groups like the International Association of Near-Death Studies, and talking with dozens of people who told stories of having out-of-body experiences, ADCs, near-death experiences, and a whole variety of other spiritual events. Then one afternoon, out of nowhere, the voice came back. It said exactly 16 words. Quote, "Do your own research and write your own book. This is your spiritual work to do." You'd think that's all it would take. The same voice that saved his kid's life, that's a voice you listen to. But apparently not when it tells you to write a book. Save a drowning kid, easy, but write a whole damn book? Fuck that noise. Plus, he knew damn well he'd be torn to pieces by the critics. He'd seen it happen to people he cared about. Stories of widows and bereaved parents suddenly communicating with their dead loved ones was well known throughout the psychological literature, and it even had a name, and the name was grief-inspired hallucinations. The key word, of course, being hallucination. No, writing a book was out. Deep down, Bill knew it was simply too much for him to take on. But whatever supernatural force was behind the voice wasn't finished with him yet. The phone rang. It was Bill's friend, Darcy Miller, and she had a very strange tale to tell. Her elderly mother had recently died after a long battle with cancer. Within half an hour, Darcy went to personally inform her mother's best friend. But when she got to the door, her mother's friend Rose already looked rattled. From the book, quote, Rose said, "The strangest thing just happened. Your mother came through the wall of my apartment and said, 'I have always loved you, and I always will.' Then she left." No one had called or told Rose that Darcy's mother had died. Rose had her ADC before she received any news of her friend's death. For Bill, this changed everything. This was the key. Cases where people had ADCs before they knew their loved one had died could not possibly be having grief-inspired hallucinations. He'd known about cases like this for years, but until his friend called, they hadn't entered his mind. How could he have missed this? What else was he missing? Do the research. Write a book. He had the time, the means, and in the back of his mind, he had hope, because he knew exactly who could help him pull this off. As soon as he hung up the phone with his friend Darcy, he called his ex-wife. There are two kinds of hope. One is the sweaty, begging, shitty, praying kind. Oh God, I hope I'm going to win this hand of blackjack. Oh fuck, I woke up late. I hope there's no traffic today. The other kind of hope is harder to come by. It's a feeling more than a wish. It's relaxed and assured. A desire for an outcome, sure, but it's optimistic when it could just as easily be pessimistic. Like an athlete stepping onto the field, knowing anything could happen, but also knowing, I got this. Like you and fate are working together, hand in hand. It's almost like you know the outcome ahead of time, like it's already happened, and now you're just waiting to get there. Have you ever had this kind of hope? I have. What's remarkable about this feeling is that it is almost always right. The hoped-for outcome arrives right on schedule. When I'm in this place, I'm always very aware of it. It always feels fragile, like it could dissolve at any second. Like if I think about it too much or examine it too closely, it'll slip away from me. But it never does. I've come to view this feeling as a gift in and of itself. Now, usually it's small stuff, but there was one time I floated on the balmy seas of giddy hope for months. And what made it strange was that it was in a situation that was far from certain. Now, it had to do with an idea for a TV pilot. Would you like to know the title? Heavenly. Look, at least it didn't have an exclamation point. I was in the final weeks of production on a show called The Gates, and if the title evokes The Gates of Hell, you wouldn't be far off. Once we finally wrapped, I had plans to crawl into a dark room and lie on the floor and cry for 3 months. It's always good to know your next project. But it was right around this time that my friend, a producer I'd worked with before, Ross Feynman, called me up and said, "Rich, it's Ross. Gavin Erickson is looking for a spiritual procedural. We gotta give him one." Now, at the time, Gavin Erickson was the head of drama development for the CW network. I'd worked with him before, too. He was at ABC back when we did Miracles. I knew him and I liked him, but I was confused. I asked Ross, "What's a spiritual procedural?" "Exactly," he said. Oh, God, I understood immediately. He had asked Gavin Erickson, and Gavin Erickson had said, "Exactly. In other words, you tell me." Now, in a way, my show Miracles had been a spiritual procedural. The three main characters would respond to supernatural situations that always involved faith or belief of some kind, and they'd stick around until the situation was resolved. But the concept was a little soft. It wasn't like The X-Files. In The X-Files, they work for the FBI, and everyone knows what that is. I mean, they carried guns. It was a crime show, at least in structure. But Gavin Erickson wasn't asking for a crime procedural like The X-Files, or even a supernatural procedural like Supernatural. He wanted a spiritual procedural. But what did that mean? "That's what we need to figure out. But he definitely wants to work with us, Rich," Ross said. "This is ours to fuck up." An unfortunate choice of words, because I felt like I just spent a year doing exactly that. Working on The Gates and having all my better, kinder instincts obliterated by everyone around me left me in a weird emotional landscape. I was punch drunk, numb. My whole body felt like a giant hunk of frozen earth. I was the walking wounded, the living dead. I had never felt more creatively depleted in my entire life. For the first time ever, I felt ambivalent about my career, and I doubted my judgment. I had willed The Gates into existence. It was the project that absolutely had to happen, no matter what. And I had lived to regret it. Starting a new endeavor so soon felt like jumping from the frying pan into another frying pan. I just needed a break. Ross and I met for breakfast at Moe's, a sort of bar that also serves breakfast and lunch. It was just outside the gates of Warner Brothers, right across the street from Bob's Big Boy. Ross and I were sitting at a table drinking coffee while I ate my traditional Greek omelet. "So," he said, "I have an idea. It's about an angel." "Fine, great, whatever," I thought, "because I've got nothing and I don't care." Ross went on to tell me about a guy he knew, a great big guy, 300 pounds, with a giant black beard and covered in tattoos. He looked like a heroin-dealing dropout from a biker gang, which is exactly what he was. But he was currently working as a counselor at a drug rehab center because he himself was in recovery, and he knew exactly how junkies think. He was literally saving people's lives every day, but he looked more like a guy who would murder you. "What if that's our angel?" Ross said. "What if he's been sent back to Earth to help people because of all the people he hurt during his life?" I totally got what he meant. It wasn't a bad idea at all. In fact, it was great. The only problem, as far as I could see, was that I couldn't write it to save my life. I mean, what did I know about drug addiction? Or recovery? Or motorcycles? What did I know about biker gangs or a life of crime or any of the things I would need to know that would give this story the ring of truth? And I told Ross I'd think about it. He insisted we put another breakfast meeting on the books before this one ended, otherwise he knew he'd never hear from me. Fine, whatever. We made a date for the following Monday, and I didn't think about the idea again until my drive back to Moe's the following week. It was a sweaty August morning. I drove the 3-mile stretch of Forest Lawn Drive, with the great sweeping hills of green grass and gravestones rising up on my left. A single clump of mourners dressed all in black stood around an open grave under a harsh and unforgiving sun. Wow. Those people had real problems. I mean, I'd been beaten up by a tough show. They were burying someone they loved. I didn't know what trouble was. I pictured myself standing among them like a visitor from outer space. "Why are you sad? What do you mean you are saying goodbye? What is goodbye?" Then I had an idea. At Moe's, I let my omelet go cold. "What about this?" I said to Ross. "There's an angel, a celestial being. He's like a guardian angel, like when people have a car accident or a heart attack and their life hangs in the balance. He's the guy who tips the scales and nudges them back to life, if he can, if it's a possibility. He's an angel of the crisis moment." I was rolling. Not sure exactly where I was going, but Ross and I had worked this way before. Just toss the idea out and work it back and forth like pizza dough until it started to rise, or whatever pizza dough is supposed to do when you toss it to make it into a pizza. "So the key to the whole thing is this angel," I said, "he's never been human. He doesn't know what it's like to be an actual human. He's been among us, but never one of us. He doesn't know how food tastes or how the ocean smells. He's never eaten ice cream. He's never been lied to. He's never had a cold. He's never stubbed his toe. He's never been kissed." Suddenly, I was overjoyed. This was a character I could write. A complete innocent. A guy who takes joy in what all of us take for granted. But a guy who is also hurt by the daily soul punches the rest of us have all become accustomed to. He's the opposite of cynical. Oh God, I loved him. I didn't even know him, and I loved him. And Ross was digging it. "So what, God makes him human as like a punishment to teach him a lesson?" No, that didn't feel right. I wanted it to feel joyful and exciting and dangerous and overwhelming and life-affirming, like a complete renewal, like falling in love. So I said, I think he saves a woman. And she's different from any other person he's ever saved. It's like when he touches her, he suddenly has all these feelings, human feelings, and that's never happened before. I felt like once this angel got a taste of human emotions, it would change everything for him. He'd have to keep feeling it, like a drug he had to do again. Wow, maybe I knew more about addiction than I thought. Ross leaned in and said, "She's a lawyer. Pro bono, street-level stuff, human stakes. He starts helping her so that he can be around her and figure out what happened and why he suddenly has all these feelings. And of course, he's in love with her, but he can't tell her how or why. She thinks he's a regular guy. She has no idea he's an angel. That's his secret. He's the spiritual. She's the procedural." And just like that, we had it. I could feel the cold, hard chunk of frozen earth inside my body starting to melt. It had a long way to go, but it was starting. It was the dead-ass dog days of summer, but in my soul, it was early spring. The sun was gentle, the air was cool, and something that was dead was coming back to life. Something was starting to grow. Okay, want to hear some stories from Hello from Heaven? Yeah, you do. All right, here's one of my favorites. The witness's name is Ken, and this is about his coworker, Oscar, who died from a stroke. Now, the reason I love it is because it's so non-dramatic and almost has to be real. Okay, here it is, from the book, quote, "I always had a great deal of admiration for Oscar, although I never saw him very often. I really didn't spend a lot of time thinking about his death, you know, just that he was gone and I was going to miss him because I couldn't talk to him and, you know, things like that. So a couple of months after he died, I was walking down the hallway in my office as I did 1,000 times a day, and all of a sudden, I felt Oscar. I wasn't in a reverie or even thinking about him. In fact, I was walking to the reception area to meet a client. I felt his presence. It was all around me. It was like I had been immersed in a bubble of his energy. And I got a sense of joy. It was like seeing Oscar again. But I just kept walking, and then he left." It's perfect. I mean, it's almost a non-story. And look at the language. He doesn't say that he suddenly had a memory of Oscar, some moment they shared together, and it filled him with emotion. He says he was, quote, "immersed in a bubble of Oscar's energy." Now, I gotta say, that is something I have never felt. For someone living or someone dead, I can honestly say I have never described anything in terms even remotely like this. It doesn't feel like a normal thing. But this talk of feeling someone's energy, it comes up a lot in these reports. Here's another from a guy named Dale, who had an encounter with his partner, who had died of AIDS over a year earlier. Quote, "It was about 1 or 2 in the morning, and I was dead asleep in my bedroom. My eyes were closed when, all of a sudden, what awoke me was this brightness. It was like somebody put a flashlight in front of my face. It was that bright. When I opened my eyes, Robert was standing over me right by my bed, not even half a foot away. There was this intense bright white light around his form that was coming from within him that didn't hurt my eyes. The rest of the room was pitch black, but I wasn't afraid. I couldn't quite see through him, but he wasn't solid either. There were these swirls of vapor totally surrounding his body, and these ripples of vapor were moving. His clothing was like a robe, maybe, with a hood. Robert radiated an intense love that penetrated every bit of me like a merging of energy. Every fiber of my being felt love. There was total love, understanding, and compassion. I touched his right arm with my left hand, and I felt a lot of heat coming from his body. I also felt a high vibration, like if you put your hand on a massager. Then Robert took my left arm and put it back down by my side and just disappeared. The light went with him. It was sudden, like if you suddenly turned a light off." Okay, what's interesting to me about this one, again, the description of energy. feeling someone's energy merging with your energy. Again, this is not how I have ever described any interaction I've ever had with anyone. Sorry, Susan. It also doesn't describe anything I've ever felt in a dream. Some of you might be saying, but Rich, they said they were asleep. Wouldn't it make a lot more sense to just assume they were dreaming? Well, here's the thing. There's a lot of stories in this book that occur when people are asleep, or just falling asleep, or just waking up. Most of them go out of their way to distinguish that they were not asleep during the encounter itself. Now, maybe there's a reason for this connection between various sleep states and ADCs. Remember the book Induced After-Death Communication, the one that I did earlier this season? Dr. Botkin used EMDR, eye movement desensitization and reprocessing, to replicate a kind of REM state, which is what we experience while sleeping and dreaming. And it was this state of induced receptivity while completely awake that led to his patients' after-death communications. So maybe there's something about this REM state that facilitates receptivity to all ADCs, whether they're induced in a therapist's office or arrived at naturally and randomly in various pre- or post-sleep states. It's frustrating, I know. Anything related to sleep can be too easily written off as dreams. But some stories in this book are described specifically as dreams, which indicates that people know the difference. They don't try to dress them up as something they're not. Whenever I have dreamed of a dead loved one, me personally, it's always murky, and there is no communication at all. They are vaguely present at a family gathering or something, and I'm in the dream thinking, wait a second, they're dead. This doesn't make sense. How can they be here? Have you ever had a dream like that? Well, the encounters in this book aren't like that. Here's an example of a dream after-death communication from a woman named Anne in Maryland. Now, this happened when she was 21. Her brother Barry had been killed recently in a motorcycle accident. Here's her dream, quote, "I was in the backyard at my parents' cottage, and Barry came walking towards me. He was wearing jeans and a flannel shirt, his usual costume. His blonde curly hair was full of light. He looked beautiful. He seemed very happy, content, and full of love. And he also seemed worldly, like he knew everything. No doubts, no questions, just full of confidence. A beautiful light was behind him and around him. I said, Barry, what are you doing here? He said, I came to tell you that everything is all right. I asked, what do you mean? Didn't it hurt when you died? Barry said, it did, for a minute. It felt like a squeezing sensation. But then I was riding down a dark tunnel, and all of a sudden I came into this beautiful, brilliant white light. He kept smiling at me, and I was feeling full of love and light myself. It was so intense. He said, I just want to tell you that I love you, Anne. Then he turned around and walked away. I immediately woke up, and all the anger and frustration I felt about his death was gone. I really believe Barry came to tell me he was fine so that I would be okay. I call it a dream for not being able to give it another name, but it really happened. Here's another. This one is from a guy named Greg, and it's an encounter he had with his best friend Evan, who was electrocuted in an industrial accident at a construction site when they were both only 20 years old. So here's what he says, quote, "Two nights after Evan died, I had a dream. I was where the road splits to go to my house and to his house. We were standing and facing each other, and everything was lifelike. We were really excited about seeing one another. Evan was so happy and cheerful. He appeared the same as always and in good health. He had a great big smile on his face. And I asked him, what happened? And he said, oh, okay. I was putting a light fixture on a 20-foot pole when I hit some electrical wires. Something happened and I started to fall. Evan said he felt scared at the moment. And then he felt nothing else. He said, I promise I didn't mean for that to happen. He also wanted to assure me that he suffered none whatsoever throughout the experience. He told me he didn't want any of us worrying about him or being extremely sad that he was gone because he was in a great place. He was well taken care of and very happy, waiting for us to join him someday. And then I woke up. I had never had a dream like that before. It was very special to me that I was able to communicate with Evan after he died. It was like we parted with the realization that we'll be back together someday. Okay, neither of these dreams sounds like any dream I've ever had. What they sound like are classic after-death communications. Ross and I pitched the idea for Heavenly to Gavin Erickson on the final day of August in the year of our Lord, 2010. Later that night, I took my son Owen, his friend Eli, and his cousin Gabriel to see Green Day at the Verizon Amphitheater in Irvine. During Boulevard of Broken Dreams, a huge image of an angel was projected onto the giant screen behind the band. What an odd bit of synchronicity, I thought. This is a sign. The pitch is gonna sell. Gavin Erickson is gonna buy it. And as the song ended, I checked my phone. Ross Feynman had just sent a text. Quote, Gavin Erickson called. We sold Heavenly. We're in business with the CW. Great work, buddy. I knew it. Now, when you sell a pitch to a network, it means that they're gonna pay you to write an outline, a script, and then one rewrite. In the case of Heavenly, all this work would take place during the fall of 2010. And so, a season that I thought would be consumed by PTSD from the Gates turned into an escape into a world and a character that made me feel alive again. But wait, you're saying. Shouldn't you be feeling insecurity and stress and depression? I mean, after all, this is Richard Haddam's paranormal bookshelf. As the old lady used to say in all those Wendy's commercials, where's the grief? Well, that's just the thing. In this strange season, there wasn't any. Look, I don't understand it any more than you do. Maybe it was an adrenaline rush, the kind you get when you're freed from a prison camp or rescued out of a serial killer's basement. Whatever it was, I liked it. I was happy, swimming through the deep waters of creating something new. And I was loving it. Every step I took was the right step, and I didn't question anything. Now, Ross and I had decided early on to fill the show with things we loved. Whenever there was a question, the answer was always, what would make us happy? So we named all the characters after our kids, Dashiell, Owen, Lily, Spencer. The whole thing took place in San Francisco, a city we both loved. Whether we knew it or not, Ross and I were creating a hedge against disaster. His year hadn't been any better than mine. We were tired of working so hard on projects that refused to give us anything in return. If Heavenly was going to become a television show, and by now we both felt like it could, we wanted to front-load it with joy. Our story begins late one night when Dashiell, the angel, staggers into a dilapidated church in San Francisco's Mission District that's being renovated by a young pastor named Owen. You know Owen. Dad. Dashiell tells Owen his strange story about being an angel and then becoming human in a series of flashbacks relating how he found Lily in the wreckage of a gas main explosion and about how when he saved her, he suddenly felt a lifetime of human emotions cascading from her body into his, and how he realized that he had saved her once before as a small child when she almost drowned in her parents' swimming pool. In all his thousands of years of saving people, Lily is the only person he has ever saved twice. Maybe that's what unlocked all these emotions. Maybe it means something. So Dashiell asks God to make him human so that he can continue feeling these human emotions and learn more about them. And, of course, find the woman he saved. Now, his only condition is that he be allowed to continue to save people. But once he becomes human, he can't find the woman. And when he tries to save a man who's having a heart attack right there on the sidewalk in front of him, he discovers he can't. He's become just a regular human being with no divine powers at all. He is totally distraught. He can't find the woman that he's looking for, and he can no longer save people. He feels like God has lied to him. Now, Owen, the pastor, doesn't know what to make of this guy. But like any rational human being, he assumes Dashiell is mentally ill, and he offers to at least give him somewhere safe to sleep for the night. And the next day, out of pure dumb luck, Dashiell finds Lily. He blunders into the legal clinic where she works. He's mistaken for the paralegal they've requested from the firm upstairs, and before he knows it, he's working for her. My favorite thing about the character of Dashiell is that he is the most naive human being to have ever walked the earth. I knew the show was going to be compared to other shows like Touched by an Angel and Highway to Heaven, and in those shows, the angel always knows best. They dispense godly advice, they have all this deep wisdom, and if people only listened and did what they said, everything would work out fine. But we wanted to do the opposite. We wanted all of Dashiell's advice to backfire. Because he's a human being now, he's fallible, and he doesn't know how human beings work. He knows nothing about greed or jealousy or lust or ambition or insecurity, so his instincts and advice always go wrong. It's only through his empathy and his ability to hear the very faint voice of the universe in his ear that he's able to barely help anybody at all. We thought it was hilarious that he fundamentally didn't understand the most basic human motivations, and that's what gets him into trouble. And it got me into trouble, too, when it came time to come up with a client for him to try to save in the pilot episode. We wanted him to come face-to-face with extremely modern personalities and situations, so we riffed on him helping reality TV stars or influencers or Silicon Valley types and other people who find themselves washing up on the shores of their own moral weaknesses. We ended up coming up with something about a district court judge presiding over a murder case where the defendant is a sex worker. But the judge knows they're innocent because guess what? He was with them the night of the murder. The judge is the alibi. But will he admit it and ruin his reputation? Or will he let an innocent person go to jail? Yeah, I know. I didn't like it much either. I knew it was somehow wrong. So did Ross. But I didn't know exactly how or why, and I didn't know how to fix it. So, for the first and only time in my career, I made a completely irrational and potentially disastrous decision. I decided to hand in what I considered to be deeply flawed work, with the totally insane conviction that Gavin Erickson would read it, understand what was wrong with it, and provide a solution. Now, to be clear, this never happens. This decision made no sense. It was the professional equivalent of taking my hands off the wheel, closing my eyes, and stomping on the gas pedal. It was an amateur move. And I feel bad now thinking about how my recklessness must have made Ross feel. Which makes it that much stranger when, in retrospect, it turned out that my hunch was 100% correct and it paid off perfectly, and in exactly the way I thought it would. You guys, my dream just came true. I get to do a live read ad for a product I actually use and love. I love Indian food, okay? It's probably, after like cheeseburgers, it's my second favorite of all foods. And I love meals that are healthy, fast, and simple to make. So I love the Cumin Club. Let me tell you what this is. These things, they come in packets. You order them. They deliver them right to your home. Here's the beauty. You just add water. You microwave. These things take less than 5 minutes. An Indian entree, ready to eat. It is so delicious. Okay, so let me tell you how I do it. I started off with the paneer tikka masala, which is not overly spicy. And it was perfect for me in terms of spice level. But then I did a second one. I had it with the dal chawal, which is sort of a buttery rice and lentil dish. And I mixed them together. That was my dinner. So the next day I did methi matar malai. You know, I'm sure I'm pronouncing this wrong. My South Asian listeners, you're going to have to tell me how badly I'm mangling this. But anyway, the methi matar malai, it's sort of a sweet, nutty cashew gravy with peas. If you've had Indian food before, I'd say this is like a korma, and it's fantastic. So I did that one with something called pav bhaj. Pav bhaj. It's a spicy veggie stew. Again, not too spicy. You don't need to be afraid. And it was the perfect lunch. Took me 3 minutes. But they've got like 20 more entrees I haven't even tried yet, so I am working my way through. When I'm sitting here writing the podcast, I will suddenly be starving, and that is my danger zone, because that's when I will literally go into the kitchen and grab a bag of Doritos and just eat the whole thing. Don't do that. It's not good for you. It's not good for me. And that's why the Cumin Club is a lifesaver. Like I said, you add water, you put it in the microwave, 5 minutes later, you're eating it. It's a delicious Indian meal you can feel good about. Here's what you do. Click on the link in my show notes or simply go to thecuminclub.com and put in the offer code RHPB. That's going to get you 30% off. I'll say it again. Go to thecuminclub.com or click on the link in my show notes and enter the offer code RHPB, and you're going to get 30% off. Not on your first order, not in your first two orders. You're going to get 30% off every single time you order. They're going to deliver it right to your door. Eat something good, healthy, and delicious. You deserve it. You're going to feel good about it. The Cumin Club, authentic Indian flavors straight from the source to your door. What am I? I'm going to go have some right now. What am I doing here talking about it? I'm going to go eat it. The strangest and most puzzling, but also the most convincing, of all after-death communications are the ones that happen in the middle of the day when a person is wide awake. This case was reported by a woman named Anne. About a year earlier, her two sons, ages 17 and 18, died when one began to drown and the other tried to save him. From the book. It was around 9 o'clock on a Saturday morning, about a year later. I was in the kitchen putting some dishes in the dishwasher, and all of a sudden I felt there was someone in the room with me. When I turned, Bobby was standing there leaning on the refrigerator. He looked very healthy and happy. He had on a brown and white checkered shirt and a pair of brown cord pants he used to wear all the time. He looked very solid and so real that it seemed like I could have touched him. And there was a bright light where he was standing. He gave me the most wonderful smile I've ever seen, and I knew his smile was saying, "We are both fine. We're all right. Just get on with things and be at peace with yourself." I realized his message was from Justin too. I screamed and dropped the glass I had in my hand. I ran over and tried to put my arms around him, but he just disappeared. I knew Bobby had been there, and I started to cry. Here's another. This one happened to Carolyn about 2 months after her father died of a heart attack at age 63. Quote, "I was out in my garden around 10:30 in the morning, digging up some weeds in my salad patch where the green peppers were. I clearly heard my father say, 'Hi, Cricket.' Only two people in the world called me Cricket. One was my dad, the other was my mom. I turned around and my dad was there, sitting on a log with his legs crossed about 3 feet away. I could almost reach out and touch him, but I knew I shouldn't do that. He wasn't quite solid. His density was soft, like cotton candy. Dad looked like a million bucks. He had the most wonderful smile. and I could see the wrinkles around his eyes. He was wearing his old chinos, a light blue Oxford, and his white deck shoes. He looked a little younger, and all of his health was there. He said, "How are you doing, sweetheart?" I said, "Daddy, I'm so happy to see you. I'm fine." And he said, "I just want you to know that I'm okay, and I'm watching over all of you." Then he said, "I'll see you, sweetheart." And he was gone. So, here we have cases that sound very much like the other ones, except there doesn't seem to be any REM state to facilitate the after-death communication. It just happens in the middle of the day, out of the blue. I spend so much time thinking about events like this from the human point of view, but what is it like for the spirit? Is it harder to pull off in the middle of the day? How long do they have to wait, and how hard do they have to try before they finally break through into our world and say whatever it is they feel they have to say to save us? The Notes Call with the Network was scheduled for Wednesday, November 24th, the day before Thanksgiving, which meant I was taking the call in Atlanta because Susan and I were in Georgia visiting her family like we always do at Thanksgiving. It was 5 p.m. where I was. It was getting dark. I paced up and down the driveway outside Susan's aunt and uncle's house, waiting for everybody to get on the line. Ross seemed a little distant. He was waiting for us to get our asses handed to us. I looked into the front windows of the house where Susan's family was, all warm and cozy. I could see the glow of the fireplace and the Christmas lights they'd strung up around the mantle and the beginning of frost forming on the window. I looked up into the cold Georgia sky, turning from purple to dark blue. It felt like the temperature was dropping by the second. A few blocks away, I could hear the echo of kids playing some game I couldn't quite make out. Gavin Erickson came on the line. "I know it's getting late where you are, Richard, so I'll make this fast. Act one is great." Thank God, I thought. He's buying the extended flashback sequence. Mountain number one has been crossed. "Your problems start in Act Two," he said. "We're not loving the client story." Right, I thought. The judge who's fucking the sex worker, it's hideous. Of course you're not loving it. "I don't love it either," I said. "Do you have something better for me?" Again, this was an insanely naive response. I was doing cartwheels through a minefield. I could have been fired on the spot. The project could have ended then and there. Everything depended on what he said next. "I don't have the answer," he said, "but I want to tell you a story." And then he did. Here's the story. Gavin Erickson grew up in a small town outside San Diego, California. When he was in high school, he was best friends with three other guys. The four of them had been best friends since childhood. They were this group. Everybody knew them, and everyone knew they were best friends. They were practically brothers. So one night, they were all heading out, but they were taking two separate cars, two in the front car, two in the back car. And they started speeding up, chasing each other, stupid high school stuff, and I feel certain you all know exactly what I'm talking about. You probably even know what's going to happen next. The front car went out of control, slid around on a patch of wet road, and smashed into a telephone pole. Miraculously, no one was hurt. The car in back saw all this happen and slid to a halt just behind them. Then, the telephone pole that was damaged on impact tilted and fell. It smashed through the roof of the back car and killed the boy who was driving. No one else was injured. It was a bizarre, inexplicable, million-to-one-shot tragedy. But it changed everything forever. The families of those four kids who loved each other and were like family themselves suddenly weren't family anymore. They stopped speaking. Fingers were pointed. People were blamed. Lawsuits were filed. It was the worst thing that had happened to the community in a generation. Gavin Erickson said, Do you see what I'm saying? I said, yes. And I did. As far as I was concerned, the phone call was now over. We all wished each other a happy Thanksgiving and said goodbye, and then we hung up. I looked back up into the sky. It was now pitch black, and I knew exactly the story I was going to tell. All right, it's time for my favorite story from Hello from Heaven. Almost every single story in this book happens inside the witness's home, but this one happens in a very public place, which for some reason makes it even more believable to me. And it's also a place I've been before, and that helps too. The witness's name is Tanya. She's a computer systems supervisor in Texas, and she had this experience about 1 year after her friend Gina died in a car accident. From the book. I was on a layover at the Atlanta airport, en route to San Francisco. I was sitting in the airport lounge when I smelled White Shoulders, the cologne that Gina always wore. I looked up, and there she was, sitting at the table with me. She looked relaxed and as pretty as she always did, the same as I had last seen her. She had on a red and charcoal gray plaid shirt that I'd given her a few years back. I said, Gina, what are you doing here? She smiled and said, I came to see you. When I looked down, her hand was on top of mine. For a brief moment, I could feel how solid it was. It was very warm. I was a little choked for words, and she said, just relax. I want you to be happy, and I want you to stop worrying and feeling so badly about my death. I'm fine. Now, I'm not going to visit you again, so I want to make sure you get all your affairs in order. Then in the blink of an eye, she was gone, and I sat there, absolutely dumbfounded. See, when Gina died so suddenly, her affairs were in complete disarray, and maybe that was the lesson she wanted me to learn. Consequently, ever since, I've worked very hard to make sure my finances and my life are in order. Okay, I gotta tell you, if a dead friend showed up and told me to get my affairs in order at an airport, I wouldn't get on that plane. There's not enough Xanax in the world. But okay, that's not what Tanya took away from this experience. But I just love the fact that her friend showed up in an airport lounge. I wish more people had ADCs in big public places, restaurants, movie theaters, hockey games. Mostly, I love this story because it seems entirely motivated by an exterior force. Tanya was not grieving when she had this experience. She wasn't asleep or falling asleep or just waking up. She was getting ready to get on a plane. And the message she received from her friend was extremely practical. It wasn't just, I love you, I'm in heaven now, everything's totally chill. Gina's message to her friend was clear-cut, more like an assignment. Stop wasting time at the Delta Lounge drinking Bloody Marys and playing words with friends. Get a lawyer and write up a living will, damn it. Heavenly was picked up to pilot on January 31st in the year of our Lord 2011. I was immensely relieved and extremely excited, but I was not surprised. Because remember, I was floating on a cloud of hope. Whatever strange metaphysical bubble of blissful confidence I had entered into the previous August, when I had driven past those mourners at Forest Lawn on the hill under the brutal August sun, I was still there. I was still in it. And the lucky streak continued. CBS TV Studios, who was producing the pilot for the CW network, insisted that I hire an executive producer from a list of available people they currently had under contract. It was a shotgun marriage, but they didn't care. All they cared about was placing their contracted writer-producers onto shows so they could write off their salaries against actual projects. I was furious, and worse, I felt deeply threatened. I mean, this show belonged to me and Ross. We were the executive producers. And now the studio was forcing us to bring on a third partner who we didn't know and couldn't necessarily trust. I was completely blindsided. This was an unmitigated disaster, and I had not seen it coming. But my agent informed me we had no choice. That's when I looked at the list of candidates and immediately saw the name Rob Doherty. It was like a miracle. Rob Doherty was a friend of mine, a guy I'd known for almost 10 years from back when we worked together on True Calling. He was a person I knew and liked and absolutely trusted, one of the few truly good and decent human beings I'd ever met. We chose him, and the studio approved him. Disaster averted, project improved. Months earlier, when I started writing the script, I started watching other CW shows just to get a feeling for them. And one of them was Beverly Hills 90210, the reboot. There was an actor named Ryan Eggold who played a young teacher, and he had a soulful, trustworthy quality, just exactly how I pictured Owen, the young pastor. It also didn't hurt that he was good looking. On the CW, even the clergy has to be hot. So in the back of my mind, I was picturing Ryan Eggold as I wrote the part. Then, on the first day of casting for the role of Owen, in walks Ryan Eggold. I couldn't believe it. I hadn't mentioned to anyone that I had more or less written this part for this exact actor. What was happening? He read the scene, and of course he was every bit as good as I had imagined. When he left the room, I didn't say a word. I just waited to see what everyone else thought. Everyone was silent. And then our director, the legendary Mimi Leader, said, "Well, if nothing else, at least we have our Owen. He was perfect." So later that day, we cast Ryan Eggold, the actor I had secretly written the role for, and I never said a word. And it went on like that. Every time something came up that could go either way, it went ours. Every time we needed a win, we got one. Every time we needed a break, we caught one. But like every gambler knows in their heart, every hot streak has to end. The only question was, when would mine? Here is the story at the heart of Heavenly. Jared Cullen and Paul Medrano are best friends, and they're both seniors at UC Berkeley. One night, there's a party. Jared leaves and ends up getting into an accident on the way home. He crashes into the side of a building. He hits his head and has no memory of how or why the accident happened. But when the police arrive, they find the body of a pedestrian two blocks back. It's Paul, Jared's best friend, and he's been struck by Jared's car. Two families who have been as close as blood relations since their kids were little are now on opposite sides of a nasty court battle. Should Jared get off with the minimum sentence or spend the next 15 years in jail? Two families are in the process of being destroyed. Is there anything Dashiell, our former angel, can do to save them? And can he do it while keeping the secret of who and what he is from Jared's lawyer, Lily DeMarco, the woman he has saved from death twice? And all of this while he struggles to figure out how to be this new thing he's never been before, a human being. Guys, this script is a big bowl of whipped cream, a sweet, sentimental, funny, sad, beautiful piece of candy. It is earnest and goofy and tragic, and in the end, it does something almost no television shows do anymore. It makes you glad to be alive. So I ask you, did it stand a chance to get on the air back then in 2011, or even now in 2025? It's a question I never asked, because I was absolutely certain the answer was yes. Back then, I never had a doubt. We filmed the pilot for Heavenly over the course of only 7 days in March in Vancouver, Canada. 7 days is an extremely tight schedule for an episode of television, but for a pilot, it's nearly impossible. The margin for error is non-existent. No time for experimentation, no time for do-overs or second thoughts or ideas for refinements that come a day or even an hour too late. Every time we aimed, we had to hit the bullseye on the first shot. So that's what we did. We didn't know it at the time. There was almost no time to question or reflect. We just had to keep moving. But it felt good. It felt right. And not just for me, for Ross, for our director Mimi, for the cast, everyone felt like we were nailing it. But being on set can be deceptive. Sometimes the exhilaration of making your days tricks you into believing you're really getting what you need on film. And it's not until the editor gets their hands on the footage that you truly know what shape you're in. Our editor, Stan Salfus, had been assembling scenes as each day's work was sent to him from Canada. So by the time we all flew back from Vancouver, he had already finished a rough cut. We walked into the screening room that morning knowing that our fates were pretty much sealed. We'd have time to make some changes, but not much. If we could bring it up even 10% from where it was, it'd be a miracle. Our only hope was that it was mostly there already. It wasn't. It was all there. Every beat, every line, every move, every reaction, every emotion, every note of music, everything we had hoped for, and more. It was all there, on screen. For the next 10 days, we made small refinements and took something that was amazing and made it truly extraordinary. I cried every day at the same scenes, at the exact same moments. I laughed at all the same jokes. It never got old. It just got better. We turned in our final cut to the network the first week of May. Now, we knew we wouldn't hear their decision until at least May 15th, which was the day before CW publicly announced their fall schedule at the Upfronts presentation in New York City. But on May 10th, Gavin Erickson called me. His boss, the head of Viacom, who owned both the studio and the network, had just seen our pilot. And for the first time in 9 months, I felt a jolt of pure, ice-cold fear. A memory of another phone call fought its way up from my subconscious. A phone call about my first pilot, Miracles. The head of ABC had watched it and declared, "This show will never be on my network." The reality of my current situation became very clear to me, how precarious it truly was. I felt like a tightrope walker who gets within 10 feet of the end and then suddenly looks down. "What did he say?" I asked, my heart pounding in my throat. "No decisions have been made," Gavin said, "but let me put it this way. You should be very, very happy." At the end of their book, Bill and Judy Guggenheim finally address the question that has been alive in readers' minds for a few hundred pages. Why doesn't everyone get to have an ADC? What about all the thousands, even millions of people who have lost a loved one? Parents, children, husbands, wives, who never get a reassuring message from beyond. Where is their comfort? From the book, quote, "Does this imply that a deceased child, spouse, parent, or other loved one doesn't care enough about his or her family's pain and suffering to establish after-death contact? Are these grieving people somehow less worthy of having ADCs than others who do have them? Have they been abandoned when they most need comfort and reassurance?" Unfortunately, it is here where the book finally disappoints. First, they suggest that some people who experience ADCs have grown up in a culture or a family where these experiences are accepted as a normal part of life, so they're naturally more open to them. Then they suggest that those of us wishing to have an ADC need to actively seek them out, or even pray for them to happen. Finally, they recommend meditation as a pathway to tune in to the more subtle energies around us. Now, I'm not doubting these methods, but something about praying for an ADC and then having one feels more like a self-fulfilling wish than something that happens naturally without conscious awareness or effort or expectation of any kind. To me, it feels more genuine if it happens all by itself, out of the blue. Maybe there are other factors at play. Maybe the deceased loved one isn't allowed to reach out. Maybe they want to make contact but don't have the skill or the strength. Maybe they realize that in some cases, it might be frightening or upsetting. Maybe they try in a million ways, and it is us who are simply unable to hear their voices or see their shining faces and the new, unearthly glow they have acquired wherever it is they now reside. Or maybe the dead know that in the unseen map of our lives, it is required that we travel through hard and uncertain terrain and make our own way and find whatever peace and strength we can on Earth. Countless people have found hope and reassurance here among the living, and countless others have provided it to friends and loved ones in need. We want the angels sent from heaven. But as we all know, when it comes to heavenly messages from beyond, there are no guarantees, and you don't always get what you want. You should be very, very happy. Those were the last words I heard from Gavin Erickson before everything ended. And isn't that the only sane advice for living on Earth? For most of us, for most of our days, we should be very, very happy. But we aren't. Because the future is not guaranteed, and absolutely anything can happen. Lives can change in the blink of an eye. Cars hit telephone poles. Best friends die. Families fall apart. Things go wrong. Angels come to Earth and try to bring peace and reassurance, but saving people becomes a sometimes proposition. And it's because we know this that we can never quite relax and let go of our fear that no matter how good today is, tomorrow could bring us to our knees. And this is why we can never truly be very, very happy. For the people in Hello from Heaven, the process goes the other way. First, they have the worst day of their life. And then later, sometimes a day, sometimes a decade, they have another day where they find out everything actually is okay. There's no reason to fear, because at the end of the end of the end, everything is okay. You're okay. The people you love are okay. It really, truly is gonna be okay. Now, you can snicker or sneer at this idea, but wouldn't you rather just spend one day in the calm and secure assurance that whatever track you're on is the right one, and there is absolutely no reason for fear? For 9 months, I floated on a wave of good feelings, and despite all the challenges of writing and producing a network television pilot, I was happy. Stupidly, sublimely happy. Very, very happy. And then it ended. It ended like this. We had been told that Heavenly was a shoo-in. We felt assured that our show was being picked up to series. There was one slot left on the CW, and they were poised to pick up a show from CBS TV Studios, and that show was going to be ours. But at the last minute, the new head of the network made a stunning decision. He decided to pick up a pilot that had been produced for and passed on by CBS. Since both networks were owned by the same company, it was totally within his rights. It's just that nothing like that had ever been done before. The show that CBS passed on, the one the CW then picked up instead of Heavenly, was a dramatic thriller called Ringer, starring Buffy the Vampire Slayer star Sarah Michelle Gellar. It was seen as a bold, creative, and totally unexpected move by the new head of the network, and it was. Heavenly was the collateral damage. Ringer got a second chance at life, while Heavenly died quietly and well outside the spotlight. And no angel wandered by to save it. A pilot is not a person. Heavenly never made it to air, but months later, I finally mourned its passing. And now, on some rare Wednesday nights, I'll take out my single DVD copy of it and show it to my UCLA classes. And they always like it, and sometimes they love it, and they always ask, "Can't you do something with it? Can't you sell it somewhere else?" And then I have to explain to them how network television works, where thousands of hours and millions of dollars are spent producing pilots that are not chosen, and those pilots go away and are dead forever. Heavenly was born and died 15 years ago. But it goes on. I still see it, and I still love it. And I remember every second of its life. And when I watch it, and I see Dashiell Coffey screwing up the one life he's been given, but also loving it, and knowing that one day it will end, I feel hopeful, and I feel good. And I can almost believe that maybe, even in death, everything really is going to be okay. Thank you for joining me on Richard Haddam's Paranormal Bookshelf. Richard Haddam's Paranormal Bookshelf is presented by Astonishing Legends, 134 West, and Summerland Entertainment. Executive producers Scott Philbrook, Forrest Burgess, and Susan Lambert. Our associate producers are Tess Feifel, Sailor Franklin, and Harrison Marks. Our sound designer, editor, and engineer is Kevin Ducey. Artwork is by Tommy Beaver. Our website is by Kayla Lord. And our music, as always, is by Nima Kazzaruni. Please join us next time for one of the most famous poltergeist cases of all time, the Enfield Poltergeist in This House is Haunted. Until then, be safe and be well, find the light in the dark, and we'll see you again soon.